Valparaiso University in Indiana, finishing up my second week here at Holden. The topic here this week has been handling the Bible's hatreds, and we've looked mostly at a series of figures whom either the Bible itself deliberately meant to push into a category of outsider or enemy, and some of which were characters or groups whom the Bible's readers have found ways to push outside into categories of outsider and enemy, even though the Bible itself may have not intended to do so. The subtopic for today is miscellaneous villains, and I have meant this to be a kind of, I suppose, Bible study version of Geraldo Rivera, in which we will sit around and think about biblical folks we love to hate and talk about the people whom we have always considered to be the worthy enemies of God's people. But we are pledged to begin, if possible, with at least a little bit of humor to get ourselves warmed up here. So I found out yesterday that I own a Bible, my brand new Oxford annotated Bible, which with the new RSV translation is one that will probably someday have a name because it's got a rather interesting printing mistake in it. And such Bibles generally do take a position of some status. This particular brand new edition of the NRSV, in the book of Joel, where there is this prophecy about the pouring out of God's Spirit upon people, it reads like this: I will pour out my Spirit on all flesh. Your sons and daughters shall prophesy. Your old men shall dream reams. It's interesting to ponder, yeah, exactly what that means. Does that mean they'll begin to do it on paper and lots of it, or just what? But as was alluded, this is the kind of thing that a spell checker at the publishing company would not catch, because it would recognize it as a legitimate word and not do anything about it. Those of us who do what I do for a living, namely teach, run into this kind of stuff all the time, and all sorts of interesting things creep into student papers because most of them are written between 3 and 5 in the morning. And sometimes even a spell checker won't help you at that point. And then also on examinations, which, you know, the later into exam week the examination is taken, the more likely it is that a person is suffering from cranial trauma of various sorts, and strange things creep in. So I brought a few of these. I didn't bring them on purpose. They were in a file that I brought with me, but they'll come in handy. I teach a lot of different kinds of courses, so these are from different sorts of contexts. One example of a doctrine is the doctrine of confession and absolutism. I teach a course in the Gospels, and the Gospel of Mark has this literary style in which everything happens very rapidly, and so on a final examination, one student wrote, Mark's gospel was written vibraciously, so that when read, it is fast moving. Vibraciously. I now teach that Mark is vibracious. Here's another one. Mark tells of the betrayal of Jesus by Judas in the Garden of Yosemite. Some of them aren't, you know, malapropisms or that kind of mistake, but you sort of get the idea of how close to the end of someone's rope they get at the end of finals when you read some of these exams. Here's a summary of the life of Jesus. Jesus was born in 4 BC, died and rose again in 29 AD. He was an obscure child, always wandering. When he was 3 or 4 years old, he was baptized by John and was all over the desert teaching God's word. He practiced his healing ability among many frightened and stunned people. That's the whole thing. The last one of these is an explanation for some of the commandments, and as a reason for obeying the commandment about the Sabbath day, a student wrote that the purpose is to set aside a day to participate in the exoneration of God. So, last hour we spent a little bit of time exonerating God. I have a whole collection of such things and files of these, and I also have a few books that contain such things. There's a wonderful little book out by Richard Lederer, L-E-D-E-R-E-R, who's written a number of books about the English language, and there's one new one out. Could we shut that door up there maybe, please? Anyway, this new book out by Richard Lederer is called Anguished English, and it contains chapters of various kinds of ways that the English language has gotten bollocksed up in various circumstances, all the way from gaffes of this kind on student papers and so forth. There's one chapter on messed up translations of other languages into English in places where signs or whatever have been posted to help English-speaking tourists. And a couple of them I've used a few times, I just happen to remember. There's in a Mexican hotel where they had a very fine restaurant, there was a sign posted that said, "We are aware that many U.S. people fear the water in Mexico. Please be assured the water is safe here. Every bit of water served in this hotel has been passed by our head waiter." Sort of odd form of reassurance. In a Belgian hotel lobby, in a place where elevators are referred to as a lift, there was a sign that said, or was taped on the elevator door, it said, "We regret to say that the lift is broken and will not be repaired until tomorrow. In the meantime, you will be unbearable." One of the staff members was in the 7:40 session this morning, and he has the same book, and he remembered one from some kind of elementary school child's paper that said that Sir Walter Raleigh circumcised the world with a 100-foot clipper. Well, that should get us in the mood to do Geraldo or something like that. So the idea today is to cite whatever people it is that we're accustomed to thinking as the Bible's hated folk, or folks we love to hate in the Bible or feel it okay to do, and we'll see then if there is any possibility for redeeming or rehabilitating those folks in the way that we've been doing to various people this week, including Judas and foreign women and the older brother in the Good Samaritan parable and so forth. So did any of you happen to think about this who were here on Thursday and knew we might do this? And these people are loaded for bear over here. I suppose, you know, they're going to cite, you know, King Manasseh's nephews or something. Anybody got a candidate for people we love to hate?
Herod the baby killer.
Herod the baby killer?
The beast, the Christian player, with a strange number.
Who? Oh, the...
The beast, 666.
Okay, well, what were you going to say?
It's a personal one, in the story of Martha and Mary.
Ah. Because... Okay.
Salome.
Salome in the John the Baptist's beheading story?
Yeah.
Salome's mother. Yes.
All right, what a list that is.
Do non-productive fig trees work?
non-productive fig tree. That fig tree didn't get a fair break.
Delilah
who cut off Samson's hair.
How about the serpent?
The serpent? Well, we got about 2 weeks worth there. Some of those offer some interesting possibilities. Some of them we have so little to go on, it would be difficult. Jezebel, for example, we talked very briefly about that last hour. There's just so little information. She is alleged to be just a purely mean-spirited, selfish person who made life difficult for everybody, including her king husband and Hebrew prophets like Elijah and others. We're not given a whole lot to work with. Who were some of the others?
Herod.
Yeah, the Herod that we normally think of as the really despicable character, the one who instigated the massacre of the Bethlehem children at the time of Jesus' birth. There's very little to go on to attempt to rehabilitate him. The story of that massacre is somewhat stylized in the way that it's reported in the Gospel of Matthew, but most historians and commentators believe that it's very well within the realm of possibility that that particular person would have done something like that. The Romans had a saying about him. This is Herod the Great, who was in power from about, was it? It was a long time. It was something like 40 BC until 4 AD. So it was a good long rule. But he... The Romans had a saying about him in Greek, which I will only give you two of the Greek words of. They said it was better to be Herod's hus than to be his huios. Hus is Greek for pig and huios is Greek for son. The only difference being a little iota squiggle. Because Herod had all of his sons, except one or two, murdered, and he had 70-some, lest any of them become a rival to him and try to overthrow him. And so Herod was known to be utterly paranoid about anyone attempting to take his throne, and so it's quite within his character to have perpetrated a massacre if there was even a remote chance that a pretender to the throne might be out there somewhere. And I had a colleague one time who used to enjoy reminding people, for whatever reason, that you can tell that there is at least some justice in the world because Herod died of worms. So there is a person who definitely has been put into a bad light in the scriptural tradition, and I, for one, don't quite know how to get him out without any more information than I have. The Herodian dynasty seems to have been a series of people who ruled mostly in a very self-serving way, and so I can't help much with poor old Herod without more information. The Beast, 666. Obviously, the 666 thing has been a fascinating beast to many generations, and I once read something that explains that, or gives a whole list of the people whose names have been calculated to correspond to the number 666, with various ways of fitting the numbers into or the letters of the alphabet into numerical value. And so people like Luther and Hitler and Franklin Delano Roosevelt and all sorts of others that folks didn't like have all been allegedly the beast with the 666. I once figured out how to make it work with Niedner so that I could get into a list of such folk. But I think that the most likely explanation is that if you take the Latin alphabet and put them as numbers and use the official name of Nero, which would have been Neron Caesar, you calculate that out, it comes to 666. So it's likely that the Book of Revelation was using Nero, whose reign was over by that time, as the symbol of the beast. And I don't know how to redeem Nero either. That's not a very ingratiating character. Mary, from the Mary and Martha story, anybody rehabilitate her? Is that, that's the problem? Put Mary on garbology. Yes.
Doesn't that? I was struggling with that. Correct me. I think it comes right after the Good Samaritan, and right before the Olive Prayer.
Well, let's look it up. It's in Luke.
Because my question was, how can a story about women also be a story, I mean, which we've taken so much into our self-images, women, are you and Mary or Martha? But in what sense is this a story for all people, in the same way that the stories about men are supposed to be stories for all people? And I thought that maybe it was really a story about getting from the go and do likewise back to prayer in the next prayer.
Mm-hmm.
That was
Luke 10, 38 and following.
And then finding that spot, which is, you know, we're kind of thinking about activity and contemplation, et cetera, at a hinge point. Because stories like that, which become just so associated with particular American women's behavior, I think there must be something more to the story than that. That's what I was searching for.
Yeah. Yeah, I never had noticed that, what you observed, that Martha really does play a role that has just been upheld in the previous parable, and Mary plays a role that's upheld in the subsequent paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
Praying, contemplating.
Go and do likewise, but don't only do.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And you're suggesting that they're both roles are upheld.
In the larger context,
yes.
Of the
yeah.
author,
yeah.
As the activism of the one who moves into the prayer in this section.
Right.
Just an idea, because I struggle with this one also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a frequent suggestion is that it would not have been normal for a woman to be allowed to sit, figuratively, but here literally, I guess also, to sit at the feet of a teacher and to be instructed, and for Jesus to not only tolerate but encourage that would have been an unusual kind of thing. I don't know that.
There's a kind of a reading into Martha, a self-justification motif that is correct with respect to the lawyer. In the earlier story, Luke says that he wants to justify himself when he asks the question, who is my neighbor? But you don't get that in the Martha story. She's just busy.
Mm-hmm.
But she's not cutting it up as works righteousness, Jesus Christ.
Although she's criticizing
her. Well, she's asking for help.
Yeah.
And I suppose in modern psychological discourse, she's making an I statement that I need some help. I don't know that that's so bad either. There is a comparison about who has the better part, and that leads to where Dorothy suggests that there may be a link back and a link forward. That's possible. Just both refer to the instances of the disciple.
Mm-hmm.
Both finding up the womb, doing things that are necessary, taking care of household chores, and praying as he instructed his disciples to pray, learning how to do that. That's what she's doing. She's sitting at, Mary is sitting at his feet learning from the rabbi.
I have not looked at my new Oxford Annotated on this text before, and it offers an unusual, to my way of thinking, comment. It says that the fact that the narrator says that Martha is distracted by many things is an indication that these things were not important enough to call for excessive attention or worry. With delicate ambiguity, Jesus rebuked Martha's choice of value. A simple meal, one dish, is sufficient for hospitality. Jesus approved Mary's preference for listening to his teaching, thereby accepting a woman as a disciple, as contrasted with Martha's unneeded acts of hospitality. So, as evidently the reading is that Martha was doing too much hospitality. Or a Minnesota mother. The kind that Garrison Keillor always talks about, you know. who cooks all this stuff and then claims, oh, it's really no good. This is the worst pie I ever made.
The overdoing by the woman may indicate that she's more concerned with her own need than the needs of her guest.
Yeah, there certainly seems, with this context, a warrant for seeing this as a story about balance. If my personal history with this text, though, is a clue, I guess I've always heard it like you must have, though, that Martha is picked on and Mary is held up. You know.
People who show up late get
paid. Oh, yeah.
Just as much as they've been there the whole time.
Yeah. Because Mary probably will eat after not helping. So maybe she's on dish team. Were there others? I can't remember right. Salome? Yeah, the
Yeah, your mother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is more relatives of Herod. Again, it's the same family. This time it would be the successors of Herod the Great. His kingdom was broken into three portions, and what was it? Two nephews and a personal aide or something like that took over the three parts, and the ones who ended up murdering John the Baptist were, yeah. Let's see, that's in a couple of the synoptics, but it's definitely in Mark. Mark 6 and Matthew 14. Yeah, Mark 6, 14 and following. Matthew 14, 1 to 12. This Herod, is not the Herod of Jesus' birth, but the Herod who was around at the end of Jesus' life, who was a successor to Herod the Great. No, he didn't kill all of his sons, but he killed most of his sons. Yeah. You get a little bit of a picture here of Herod not wanting to do this to John the Baptist, but for whatever reason, the wife Herodias had a grudge against John over the criticism of their the marriage she was in, and so she's the one who sort of forces her husband's hand in this. And the king is deeply grieved. Verse 26.
Is there any parallel with a pilot who gets tricked into, or who sort of has to do something, finally because of his oaths and his guests, he orders a death, even though he himself will run it off?
Yeah. That is interesting, isn't it? It puts Pilate, it puts the execution of John the Baptist and of Jesus in a parallel relationship to the one who actually had the say over whether or not it was going to happen. Yeah. How would we propose rehabilitating whom?
The Jews is the term that's used in
I see.
There's a kind of a reading of these texts, especially in John's Gospel, where it just uses the phrase the Jews, and people don't think of it as either the temple authorities who were opposed to the claims that he was making with respect to their authority,
mm-hmm.
and they read it to mean my neighbors in wherever we live, Chicago, San Francisco, or whatever, at the contemporary moment. This deicide race continues on and on, accursed because of the death of Jesus.
Well, I can certainly think of a way to keep the whole New Testament picture of Herod, all the Herods, from being used as ammunition to say anything about Jewish people. And that is because the Herods were not Jewish. The Herods were Idumeans. And as some of you will remember if you've been here for some days, the Idumea is Greek for Edom. The Herods were they were part of the descendants of the old Edomite nation, which was an enemy nation of the Israelites, and they lived down to the south and southeast in the rugged terrain down there, and they had gotten into the position they were by helping the Romans take over. And so they were collaborators with Rome, and as a reward for that, got into the position of being allowed to be the kings and collect the taxes. And in effect, that was the main thing that the kings got to do at the time, was oversee the whole revenue system. You know, Rome was really in charge, but these kings were kind of puppets and could get very wealthy doing what they were doing, and so the whole Herodian dynasty was a kind of a foreign group that was in league with the Romans and ripping off the Jewish people. So if you're going to anybody that would use Herod and Herod's behavior as evidence that there's, that the Jews act in inappropriate ways simply doesn't have enough clues as to who the Herods were. So I can't rehabilitate the Herods very well, but they certainly shouldn't be used to accuse Jews of anything. I think I explained the other day the reason why we have the book of Obadiah in the Bible, which is nothing but a one long curse against the Edomites, is because the last decisions made about exactly what went on in the canon happened after the Herodians had been, after that dynasty had ended, at the end of the Roman-Jewish wars, and the people who made the final decisions about the canon made sure that this condemnation of Edomites got in there just for the Herods. So that forever and ever we will curse Edomites, you know, and their descendants. But of course that raises the larger issue of the Edomites, and that takes us back to Jacob and Esau.
Well, my question is a little bit different. It's not just the Herod figure, but the how the term the Jews is used as an object of contempt, and how can we move beyond that? You already did last week an interpretation of the phrase, "His blood be upon us and on our people." And put that in the setting of the atonement ritual that really bespeaks forgiveness and reconciliation rather than hatred and contempt. But there is a lingering sense in which the villains that we love to hate are the Jews, and particularly for their responsibility to the death of Jesus.
Yeah, a great deal of work has been done on the whole business of Jews, the image of Jews in the Gospels in general and the Passion narratives in particular, and what was the role of the Jews in the death of Jesus. Lots of books have been published about that. And there are all kinds of theories. I can summarize some of that. The primary direction of current research about exactly how was it that Jesus died suggests more and more convincingly that it did take a conspiracy that involved all kinds of people to end up having happen what happened to Jesus, and that it did involve some Jewish people. But that ultimately Rome bears the primary, the Roman government in Jerusalem at the time, namely Pilate and the administration there, bears ultimate responsibility for what happened, because you know they took responsibility for the justice system that was to be in place there, and it failed. And many historians and other kinds of researchers have written persuasively about various motivations the Romans would have had to do away with anybody who had a fair amount of influence among common Jewish people, as Jesus certainly seems to have had. And so the Romans had plenty of reasons all by themselves to, if not instigate something like this, to certainly go along with it for their own purposes. If you look at the Passion narratives very carefully, in the earlier ones, in the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the priestly establishment seems to have something to do with what happened. And the chief priests are always the ones who are said to have been pulling the strings behind the scene and instigating the people to cry out for Barabbas instead of for Jesus and so forth. that may well have been quite the case if Jesus did some of the things he is said to have done, like go through the temple upsetting everything. And playing a role like many prophets had played, criticizing the cultic establishment in Jerusalem as being a center of hypocrisy where people could think, you know, we're doing all the sacrifices and all the other rituals correctly, therefore we're safe, we're doing what God wants, and we don't need to worry about anything else. And the prophets kept saying, well, all your sacrifices are nice, but what God wants is justice. Every one of the prophets goes through that lament almost in the Old Testament. So if Jesus, and he seems to have done this, if he behaved similarly, there's plenty of reason to believe that the priests would have responded to him in the same way that they responded to people like Jeremiah, who did something like that, threaten his life. It is the Gospel of John and the sermons in the book of Acts which pin what happened to Jesus specifically on the Jews. And there's something else that happens in the Gospel of John that's worth noting. In all the other Gospels, the Pharisees disappear from the story at about the time of the Passion narrative, when Jesus is arrested. The Pharisees have been Jesus' debate opponents all along in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But they just vanish when it comes to the point of destroying Jesus. And it's the priests who do that. The Pharisees remain opponents of Jesus, even suggested that way in the Passion narrative of John. And I think it's helpful to understand the history of the Pharisees and where they come from, and how Jesus would have been seen by his contemporaries in relationship to the Pharisees, because I think Jews and Pharisees together are really often made enemies of by Christian readers of the New Testament. If I were to say, if somebody asked me, who have you been taught is an enemy by your life as a student of the Bible, I think the first people I would say is Pharisees. I grew up thinking Pharisee meant self-righteous, Christ-killing jerk. You know. Well, if you would have asked Jesus' contemporaries to put Jesus in some category of Jewish civilization in his day, almost anybody would have said, well, the only place he really fits is among the Pharisees. That's among the folks you would have thought him to fit. Or that's the folks you've thought him to fit among. Back in 165 BC, some things had happened that sort of set the stage for the kinds of groups that were running around in Jesus' day, actually not in that year only, but in the years leading up to that. The Greek civilization, beginning with Alexander the Great all the way back in 332, had taken over that part of the world and had declared that the way to have world peace was to have one world culture and one world language and one world religion and one world art and one world everything. That was Alexander the Great's dream. And he died, of course, without being able to do anything about that dream. But in time, some of his successors did try versions of that, and the dynasty of people who took over one third of Alexander's empire, known as the Seleucids, who also controlled Palestine, tried to impose that kind of thinking on the Jewish people, and they forbade the use of the Hebrew language. They forbade the practice of Jewish religion. They insisted that Jewish people and everyone else participate in Hellenistic, that is Greek, cultures, things like the Olympics, in which you ran around in a place called a gymnasia. Gymnasia is, gymnos is the Greek for naked, nasia is the Greek for a running track. So a gymnasium is a place to run around naked, which is what the Greeks did. Lots of athletic exercise done in the nude, because the whole purpose of athletics was glorying in the wondrous physique of the human body. Well, the Torah frowns on nudity, and for Jews to participate in this was just unspeakable. You know, or to eat pork, which the Greeks insisted that they do, and not live by their dietary codes. So there had been terrible persecution. Some of it recorded of people who insisted that they had to keep the Torah alive and study it in the original language and not capitulate and become Greek. And it is to those people that we owe the fact that we still have the Bible. They kept it alive through a period when Judaism was a banned religion. Those people were known as the Hasidim, the pious ones. And many of them gave their lives to keep the religion of Yahweh alive, lest Yahweh's dream for the world die.
What was the Haggadah?
Haggadah is a Hebrew word that means narrative. And so Haggadah is, for example, the word for the narrative that you read at the Passover, the account of the Exodus that we remember on this night.
That was not the name of the group. It was the Hasidim.
The Hasidim is a Greek, a Hebrew word that means the saints or the pious ones. Plural of Hasid. A Hasid is a pious one.
It's the revolutionary group that went out to live in the desert.
That's the Essenes. Yeah. They're part of this story. The Hasidim, it's a bit more complicated than what I'm saying, but this is a skeletal version of this history. When the Hellenistic Empire was finally overthrown by the Jews and they got their own kings for a while, the kings turned out to be just as Hellenized as everybody else, and they had names like Aristobulus. Not too good of a Jewish name. They had a queen who was really very good, but her name was Alexandra. And so some Jews said, look, we fought all this way to get to have our own traditions again, and look what we got. Kings with Greek names who still do business in Greek. We can't tolerate this anymore. So a bunch of them packed up and said, it's hopeless. Even when we have our own kings, they go like this. And so they moved out. And that is the general understanding of where the Essenes came from, out in the wilderness at Qumran, in their separatist community. And so those people were one faction of the Hasidim who gave up on society being reformable. But another group said, no, you can't do that. That's a cop-out. If you want to make a point of obedience, you got to do it publicly. You got to live your life amongst the backsliders in an open public way, and wear your appropriate dress and do the rituals and everything in such a way that everybody has to see that you do it and you're not hiding it. And that's the Pharisees, the pious ones who chose to remain in the society. and keep the traditions alive.
The Hasidim, aren't there branches of that group still in the U.S. and New York?
There are Hasidic Jews, but they are not, except by name, related to the to that old movement. The Hasidim of modern times began in Eastern Europe in the early 19th century with Rabbi Baal Shem Tov, who was a fellow who's much like this character who right now is believed by many Jews to be the Messiah, who's been in the news a lot lately. And this fellow evidently was an exceedingly charismatic person who won over thousands of Jewish people in Eastern Europe into his way of reading Torah. And that group has spread, and that's where Hasidic Jews come from. They're not totally unrelated, and I don't know why they chose that name, but they too are people who insist on living with a dress that sets them apart, and with, yes, with other customs, yeah. But their teachings are not related to the teachings of the ancient Hasidim.
Hasidim also a group of revolutionaries that took new names so that they would deal with Seleucids. Really a revolutionary group, tied their legs that they would not run. Read some stuff about the revolutionary end of that.
Well, the original Hasidim in the period of enforced Hellenization were pacifists, and the people who were trying to instigate a military rebellion couldn't get the cooperation of the Hasidim, and the Jewish people were very factionalized, as they were most of the time during the biblical period and still are today, but among the groups that were at work, the Hasidim were a pacifist group, and in 167 BC, Antiochus IV, the last of the Seleucid kings, sacrificed a pig on the high altar in Jerusalem to celebrate the end of Judaism and the beginning of Zeus's reign in Jerusalem, and that was so offensive to everybody that even the Hasidim finally agreed to fight. And one of the reasons the revolution succeeded was because finally even the pacifists joined the revolt, and it worked. But I don't know about any movement, you know, any Hasidic movement that was by nature militaristic, though there may have been. I just don't know of them.
You said Jesus fit more into the Pharisees.
Jesus fit more into the Pharisees than anybody else in the day, because like them, he you can see all over the place, he was mostly observant of Torah. He did some things that tweaked the Pharisees, but he certainly didn't belong to any of the other groups.
What were the other groups?
Well, the Sadducees were the wealthy landed people who were closely allied with the priestly the groups, who were also very wealthy because they made a fortune off the temple and all the pilgrims that had to come to Jerusalem three times a year, and they couldn't carry their animals with them to do the sacrificing, so they brought up money from wherever they came from to buy animals, and you had to buy the animals only with certain approved of money. So the priests ran the exchange booths. Then the priest sold you an animal, and then you sacrificed the animal to God, only God didn't reach down and take it. It ended up with the priests, and the priests either ate it or sold it back to you. So the priests were making money three separate times off the same animal every time somebody came to sacrifice. You know, that's why, for example, in Roman times, the high priesthood was bought and sold to the highest bidder.
Yeah,
not Roman times, Hellenistic times. Because it was so incredibly lucrative that if you could be the high priest and run the temple, I mean, I hesitate to name someone who's in an analogous position today.
Had to.
Pardon me?
Had to.
Well,
yeah,
I don't have anybody in mind. Yeah. But the Pharisees...
It's hard to get on the wavelengths in the TV reception here.
The Pharisees were bitter opponents of the Sadducees and the priestly establishment. And the other party was the Herodians. Another party was the Herodians, the people who thought that the Jews should cast their lot with them. And then there were the Zealots. And Jesus wasn't any of those. The other thing that links him to the Pharisees is that in the aftermath of the persecutions among the Hellenistic people, the Hasidim taught that it simply was not possible that a just and gracious and kind God could allow all those pious people for the sake of God's law to be destroyed and not vindicated. Meanwhile, the Hellenistic persecutors lived happily ever after. And so it was those people that first among the Jews taught a doctrine of resurrection from the dead, after which martyrs and the righteous would be vindicated and the persecutors would be punished. In a response to that horrible injustice, Jews for the first time began to actually teach a doctrine of resurrection. And of course Jesus went along in that tradition, or he believed, he taught that, and so he fit the basic profile of the Pharisee. But like so many people, the people he fought with most were the ones he was most like. There was no reason to fight with Sadducees or folks like that. It was the Pharisees that he was closest to, and so he argued with them. Like about the Sabbath, for example. The Pharisees' great dream was that if just once all Jews would celebrate a Sabbath in the way the Sabbath was supposed to be celebrated, then God would take over and we would be out from under oppression and the rule of God would begin. And so that's why the Pharisees would get so distraught over people that they thought were with them violating the Sabbath day. And so when they catch Jesus out picking corn on the Sabbath in Mark 2, and they say to him, "What are you doing?" It's because they read this as yet another way that people are keeping God from beginning the rule of God. So the Pharisees are painted with a pretty ugly set of colors by an awful lot of biblical interpretation, but they really do deserve another look. He re-examines the Pharisaic tradition.
Jesus asks them to be more compassionate.
Okay, for the sake of the tape, the suggestion is that Marcus Borg's book, The Jesus, A New Vision, does a kind of re-examination of Pharisaic tradition. I do notice it's 10 o'clock. And there may be some of you needing to catch that bus there. So maybe we do need to honor the schedule and wrap it up. Well, that wasn't quite as wild as Geraldo. But But thank you very much.
Thank you.